When I and my friends were young, into our teens, we weren't cruel, but we were thoughtless. And in the course of our thoughtlessness, we did some terrible things. The couple called Bradley were English, and had come to Cairnbeg in the Perthshire Forest Hills to make a new life for themselves. They had included the small spa town on their honeymoon itinerary 16 years before, and possibly they imagined that by returning, they could rediscover earlier selves they had somehow lost sight of since. It was evident to customers of the small gift shop they'd opened that the husband was the keener. Mr. Bradley bought in the goods from reps and local suppliers, wrote the newspaper adverts himself. It was he who had come up with the name for the business, the Trinket Box. Their stock in trade was knick-knacks. They also showed in selected hotels about the town. The Clun Palace even had a Trinket Box display case in the foyer. The Bradleys must have considered that their wares would appeal to our solid middle-class tastes, failing to understand that to people like my parents, so cautious with their money, not caring to spend too brazenly on themselves, the objects were largely superfluous, much of the taste highly dubious. Glass bonbon dishes, gilt musical boxes, porcelain thimbles and ring trees, onyx hand coolers, crystal paperweights, after-eight dispensers in very meagre silver plate, factory-produced tapestry views of uncredited Scottish scenes. Mr. Bradley had been in the Navy during the war and acquitted himself well. He had stayed on because that was the only occupation he'd known in life, and thereby he deftly relegated his humble social origins to the convenient mists of time. He came out after 15 years. He may have wondered what other talents he had, or perhaps he wanted to get his wife away from that hearty Navy milieu. The base on the south coast of England was famed for its testosterone overcapacity and the bored wife's fondness for gin. Mr. Bradley had found work in an estate agent, then in a hotel, then with a firm of printers, and then in a chandler's office. Nothing seemed to suit him, however. Next, courtesy of cooperative-minded bank managers impressed by his naval credentials, he set himself up in a succession of small shops, a tobacconist's, an antique shop, finally in the fancy goods line. In the local shops, the indigenous wives of Cairnbeg were politely formal with Mrs. Bradley, but no more than that. Irene Bradley wasn't yet one of them, and their circumspection had to do with more than her Englishness or her living above commercial premises. Maybe it's a natural defence of the species to react so tentatively, sceptically, concerning anyone who looks different from us. Mrs. Bradley had chosen to have the appearance at 45 years old that she did. The brass-coloured hair, the meticulously executed face, eyebrows plucked to regal arcs, blue eyeshadow, blusher on her cheeks, fresh magenta lipstick, and her up-to-the-minute clothes à la mode de Bournemouth. Pastel woolens that hugged her up-tilted breasts, cardigan sleeves pulled back on her sunned forearms, jangly charm bracelets, narrow skirts tight on her hips, feet arched on high pencil heels. We weren't Cairnbeg natives, but annual summer holidaymakers. The Trinket Box was somewhere new for us to go on wet days, when we had nothing better to do. We'd lift the goods up and, gently enough, put them down again, without any intention of making a purchase. Slope-shouldered Mr. Bradley worried about the wet footprints tracked over the carpet tiles by our shoes and sandals, about the damp trails smeared by our cagoule sleeves. He was also afraid to lose a hypothetical customer. For all he could tell, one of us might have a birthday present to buy for a member of the family, and a bad critique from us might persuade our parents or their friends that they ought not to come in. His wife didn't have the same qualms, and she watched us closely without bothering to disguise her suspiciousness, as if she was quite aware what our opinion of the Twee merchandise was. Reps visited the shop. They parked outside when they drove a car to be proud of, round the corner in Glebe Street when they didn't. Some had pot bellies, some reeked of perspiration and tobacco. But among this class of automotive manhood were other, younger and more prepossessing specimens. For them, Mrs. Bradley always had a coyly welcoming smile and some playful banter to exchange before she summoned her husband through from the back.
"Leonard, have you got a moment?"
When there was a lull in activity in the shop, Mrs. Bradley would boil water on the downstairs gas ring and make some coffee or tea. She would return with perfume dabbed behind her ears, her lips repainted, and face newly powdered. Her feet fitted into shoes with even higher heels. The reps developed a rota, so Mrs. Bradley learned to prepare herself for their arrivals. Whom to try to avoid, whom to stay around for, whose footsteps and stride along Market Street she should keep her hearing tuned for. Maybe it was no accident that an undue number of salesmen called at the trinket box, attempting to hawk their lines. The majority still smelt of perspiration and tobacco, wore nylon shirts that wouldn't stay tucked inside the dipping waistbands of their trousers, which was why the exceptions continued to receive that smile of false bashfulness when Mrs. Bradley seemed to merely chance to materialise from behind the curtain, emerging like a mature mannequin from the back quarters into the shop. Then that husky, round midnight Londonish voice, "Oh, hello, stranger, I didn't see you there." We witnessed this happening several times. Mrs. Bradley must have realised we were there in the shop to spy, but she let us watch anyway. Mr. Bradley, on his summons, would appear from the back room. His shoulders would immediately fall and his forehead crumple, as if he had a pebble set deeply into the central portion of his brow. In a couple of seconds, his expression would have changed from bland charm, that tradesman's blatant yen to please, to something much darker. To what I now know was distrust and apprehension, a sense of grim foreboding he was helpless to do anything about. In the town, to buy postcards and Minto's the stationers, we came across a Valentine's card which hadn't been removed from the display racks on the walls. Outside again, we debated whom we could have sent it to. Walking back along Market Street and past the trinket box, it crossed several of our minds at the same moment. At the back of the shop, just visible, Mrs. Bradley was perched on one leg with one foot out of her shoe, caressing her stocking at the ankle where it had rippled and smoothing out any creases higher up on her calf. She lifted her head, noticed us lagging boys, but didn't stop what she was doing. We went back the next day and bought the Valentine card. We wrote nothing on it but drew a big heart spliced by an arrow, sealed the envelope, printed in caps Mrs. Irene Bradley's name and address, placed the stamp very neatly in the right-hand corner. We gave the card to someone to post. He was returning home to Glasgow, and we thought that that must excuse us. Such a slick alibi would get us off the hook. Mrs. Bradley looked to us precisely like the sort of woman who ought to receive such a fond token of devotion from somebody or other. We doubted very much if her soft-spoken and rather hang-dog husband was the man for it, and if the card was 6 months late, so what? Our motives were as haphazardly casual as that. The possible consequences simply didn't occur to us. It was an early closing day when the second post delivered the card. Straining to see through the window into the shop, we could just make it out. The envelope with the recipient's name and address, in caps, lying on the mat behind the locked door. The next day, Mrs. Bradley had gone. She had been spotted setting out very early that morning, walking as quickly as she could in her slingbacks, high heels scraping, across the empty cobbled square on a diagonal and downhill, a suitcase weighing down each arm. Her Macintosh kept flapping open to impede her progress. She was looking to neither left nor right, but had her gaze concentrated straight ahead towards the roofs of the railway station and the freight yard. And that was the last that anyone in Carnbeg was ever to see of Irene Bradley. Stories shouldn't peter out in a trail of conjectures and suspension of dot, dot, dots, but that's the habit of life. Her Lochinvar in Glasgow was waiting for her, or so Mrs. Bradley assumed. An examination of the postmark on her summer's Valentine card had told her who he was. Someone she didn't have any doubts must have sent it, had given her the signal she was waiting for. Her one hurried concession to etiquette was to scribble a note to her husband, but one that was to prove too cryptic for him to make any sense of. Whatever she might find in Glasgow would be worth leaving this dump of a town for. A commercial traveller in fancy goods had a surprise awaiting him once she'd reached her destination. Everything in the shop that Mr. Bradley could break, he broke. Shelf after shelf of the stuff, whatever they had sold him or provided sale or return on those nifty rates of commission they'd worked to. "Very nice to deal with you again, Leonard. You're a proper gent, and thanks for the coffee, Mrs. B. Just how I like it." The bastards. He smashed everything, crunched it all underfoot, porcelain, pottery, crystal, ground it into the soiled carpet tiles with the heel of his shoe, every last minding of them in the goddamn bloody place. When Mrs. Bradley had tracked down whoever she imagined sent her the card, he would have denied it. But the sender of a Valentine always does. Maybe she laughed off the denial, or maybe it struck to the very quick, and she had to admit to herself there was nothing she could do to persuade the man, no matter how huskily and Londonish she sweet-talked at him. Either way, she couldn't go back now to that little backwater, to Hicksville stuck up there in the Heather Hills. It was where their married life had started, but where, on an early closing day, for the very lack of romance, that same marriage had stuttered to its dead end. The shop was unoccupied the next year. Mr. Bradley had disappeared. The girls preferred at first to hurry past the spot, then, later, to cross over to the opposite pavement. We boys wouldn't be put off our steady gait, that semi-swagger. And yet, for us too, there was something unsettling about the sight of the premises. Another 12 months on, and we were now gradually becoming conscious that this minor local legend that was accumulating referred not only to the Bradleys, but to ourselves as well. A silence grew around the shop. No one else took it on. Over the raised awning, the signboard stayed in place, with its inappropriately jaunty-sounding name writ large above our heads. Old dames and housewives didn't linger by the shop even to chat, as if they were afraid of its reputation for unhappiness. The windows became grimy. The property had an unlucky look which no amount of estate agent's hyperbole could compensate for. To us, the trinket box was already like a monument of ourselves, of the gauche adolescents we formerly were. At that geographical juncture, we would always be 14, 15, 16 years old, caught fast in that difficult interlude between boyhood, with its cohesive certainties, and the irrational adult realm of passion and dream, and the reckless actions which men and women are sometimes driven to.
The Trinket Box by Ronald Frame was read by John Gordon Sinclair and produced by David Hunter.